You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is Wednesday, February 26, 2020. We are coming into the Lenten season this coming weekend. We'll kick it off. Monday will be the first full day of Lent. So today will be a political, historical discussion, I think, for the next few weeks. We'll have more specifically Orthodox spiritual discussions, because on this show, we go back and forth. The truth is, they're not really separate from one another. And it's very easy to get lost in one at the expense of the other. We're body and soul. We're not either one or the other, but it's very easy to fall into the error of stressing one over the other. As always, I need the assistance of my listeners financially. This is a particularly harsh struggle for me and for many others. And I've done what many have said, what like most people I know said was impossible, to live a life of a scholar outside of academia, outside of an institution. I'm in an enviable position, at least according to many people, because of the generosity of my readers and listeners. For those of you who have assisted me, I thank you. And the only reason that I function here at all, the only reason that this ever happens, is because of you guys. Now, I'm going to talk about Joseph Stalin. I'm going to talk about his view of World War II. Something called his 10 strikes or 10 shocks. The Russian Udaris, it could mean really any expenditure of kinetic energy. Be a punch, a blow, impact, something like that. In November of 1944, Stalin was speaking in front of the Moscow Council and workers' representatives, and he was celebrating the 27th anniversary of the October Revolution. And he said the decisive successes of the Red Army this year and the expulsion of the Germans from the Soviet Union were predetermined by a series of crushing blows against German forces launched in January of this year and then deployed throughout this present year. And he will list 10 of these, which then becomes his 10 strikes, 10 shocks, 10 blows. I'm just going to call them 10 strikes. And this is how he understands the end of the Second World War. Now, the sheer volume of words written on the Eastern Front could fill oceans. But there's good reason for this interest. The defeat of Hitler in the USSR is the single most significant event of the 20th century, by far. Nothing in the world was ever the same or could be the same after this four-year period. But this defeat occurred almost entirely in the Soviet Union. And he describes these 10 strikes. 1944 is the year of the defeat. And of course, it completely solidified Stalin's iron grip on power. Remember, tyranny doesn't exist without some kind of consent. Consent is a very slippery term. But even instinctive consent is solidified by smashing military victories. Regardless of anything else that a tyrant might do, victory in the battlefield at a certain level gives a certain title to rule. This is the worst of the most sinful elements of fallen human nature. Function at this instinctive level and give a misplaced respect to such people. Now, of course, the victory wasn't his. It wasn't Stalin's. But those under his command. And of course, as always, the United States that built up his industrial capacity and financed his war effort. We'll get to that in a minute. Now, this is how Stalin divides the year 1944. They're significant in and of themselves, but because he understood them this way. But having 10 of them is very convenient. Major General Peter Grigorenko, who I've written and talked about extensively, claimed that, of course, Stalin had nothing to do with this, that the war was won despite Stalin, and that his offensive posture and massing infantry in the far west provoked Hitler's attack and proved that it was preemptive. This is one of the reasons he was sent to a mental hospital. And he became the highest-ranking Soviet dissident in history. But these are significant. These are groups of battles. But there's a few things that they have in common. You need to remember, I was in third grade when I first started being interested in this topic. And it's never left me. Especially as the war came to an end. I'm particularly interested in the political, economic, and psychological processes, for lack of a better word, of the German and the Japanese soldier once they realize that the war is ending. And it's just a matter of how they're going to be defeated, not if. But these things have in common a few things. One of the worst is failures of German intelligence. Military intelligence, I mean. The dwindling superiority in the air, which was eliminated fairly early on. Fuel supplies. Western support for the Soviet Union. And a deeply divided German high command. You notice I don't mention the weather here, because that is not a significant factor. But the question is obvious. Why would someone like Mao or Stalin be able to hold power? Or how could they hold power for so long? Where does this consent come from? And these 10 strikes, especially as it's presented to the public, these strikes are one of the ways to answer this. The purpose here is to show how, after Stalingrad, Germany was defeated despite a Russian and Ukrainian population that didn't like the dictator of the USSR. But there is still this instinctive respect for someone who actually wins battles, no matter what else they might do. Now, the problem with approaching 1944 like this is that Stalin's 10 strikes aren't in a clear order. I mean, they're vaguely chronological, but they're often synonymous and overlapping. But to some extent, they also depend on each other. The early ones have to function for the later ones to work. So repetition is inevitable, and we're not necessarily going in precise chronological order. Now, a lot of debate exists on the so-called turning point. And there is a turning point, if only psychological. And unfortunately, for probably one of the few times in the world, I agree with establishment history that it is Stalingrad and Kursk. And as this is going on, Hitler is directing all available men and material to the Western Front, so-called Order 51. This is a very strange disconnect. From 1942 on, the Soviets had more men, tanks, planes, and supplies with greater and greater degrees of superiority. And in some cases, qualitatively, not just quantitatively. Depending on who you read, the Soviets could field about 7 million men, while the Germans fighting on three fronts managed about 4 million in the east, but that includes contingents from every European country, Hungary, Finland, Romania, and to some extent Spain, and it doesn't include partisans for either side. Now, had Germany defeated the USSR at Stalingrad, Turkey would have mobilized against the Soviets, and Japan possibly would have moved against them in the east. It certainly would have destroyed Soviet morale and granted Germany tremendous international respect and certainly a lot of fuel supplies. I don't think Hitler was incorrect in moving south rather than towards Moscow. I mean, after all, Napoleon took Moscow. It didn't make any difference. But chances are there would have been more interest in building both an Islamic and Orthodox anti-communist army under German command. And it's also worth noting that German victory would have spared the humiliation of General Paulus and his, you know, understandable treason once he surrendered to the Reds. Paulus wanted to testify, as many of you know, against Germany at Nuremberg, but everyone knew he exchanged his life for this kind of testimony. He didn't go out of his way to support the USSR, though. But what he says at Nuremberg should be discounted. I mean, he told the families of POWs after Stalingrad that they were all alive and well, and he knew damn well that 90% of them were already murdered. He knew who the criminals were here. And then we wouldn't have had the Sportplatz speech of Goebbels, where he alerted the world that Germany was now in serious trouble. And I wonder, if Germany had won at Stalingrad, would there have been more rumbling against Stalin in the armed forces? And maybe even more significant than all that, would American Lend-Lease support been stopped or at least vitiated? Well, after Stalingrad, I include Kursk along with Stalingrad, it was it. It was over. Once Japan ended up being in the same state as Germany, the USSR could then move men from the east. This force Hitler knew nothing about until it was too late. The Siberian infantry that the Germans went up against were totally immune to the cold, and very few were ever taken alive. But it should be noted that these are Russian patriots, certainly not Marxists. But 1943, I mean, to be nice about it, the Soviets had double the tanks. The Soviets could muster about 6,000 operational tanks, and the T-34s were superior to what Germany was able to put out, really right up until the very end of the war. The heavy tank didn't come out until much later. Thanks to the West, the Soviets had over 10,000 working aircraft, and Germany had fewer than 3,000, and by 1944 that was shrinking fast, as was fuel supplies and pilots. I don't have to go into the blood that was shed. 27 million just in the Soviet Union. This is a colossal waste of resources, especially human resources. The best of European manhood sent to their deaths, something that Europe has never recovered from. The Germans, according to Ernst Schramm, the diarist of the German High Command, records about 3,400,000 total casualties in Russia. All told, about 4% of the globe's population was killed in World War II. Now, the first strike, I'm going to go through this as quickly as I can. The first strike is the Leningrad one. This is about breaking the siege of Leningrad, which is a very eccentric event in World War II because it was very unlike Hitler to put a city under siege. Now, it's true that the North, and Leningrad in particular, St. Petersburg, was one of the main industrial centers of the country. And the rail lines out of it were an artery to the rest of the Soviet Union. It also was the gateway to the Baltics, who certainly wanted nothing to do with Stalin and were stalwart supporters of Germany. And of course, one of the most reliable allies that Germany had was Finland. Now, Germany's been condemned for the siege of Leningrad. It lasted for a very long period of time, 872 days. Very unlike both Hitler and the German high command. It's been considered a war crime from the Germans, although I want to note that Stalin had removed all Finnish and German population from the area and deported them elsewhere, or liquidated them, so as not to have Hitler have this reserve army in front of him. And, of course, would very soon liquidate the nationalist movement. He will also deforest the area, looking for these forest movements in Lithuania and elsewhere. He will bulldoze acres and acres and acres of forest. And the Germans certainly never thought that Leningrad would hold out for so long. And of course, the siege of Leningrad lasted as long as it did, partially because they did permit the so-called Road of Life, a very small outlet, one road, that permitted about 1 million civilians to escape and wounded to be evacuated. The Germans could have destroyed it, but they did not. Stalin wouldn't be so merciful later on. But it really wasn't broken until almost the very end of the war. And we're talking here in 1944. This was where it began to finally fall apart. The situation in Army Group North, of course, the German army initially had three sectors. At the end of 1943, Army Group North, whose purpose was the Baltics and Leningrad, was critical. It was almost seen as a war in and of itself, separate from the rest. Army Group Center was in a lot of trouble in Belarus, and so their front had to be extended 100 miles. So as always, fewer men were asked to do more with less equipment. Now, of course, here's one of the first times you come across a refusal to retreat. Operation Blue was a plan to put out a 200-mile retreat to the Narva frontier near Pskov, the so-called Panther Line, and so the two battered corps, the 26th and the 28th, could rebuild. It probably would have been a very good idea, but Hitler said no. He wanted the Reds as far as possible from Germany. He was also very worried about the U-boat training facilities near the Baltic. But worse than that, Hitler transferred some of the best infantry out of Army Group North to reinforce the South. Still, though, Army Group North did extremely well. And Soviet attacks they had as many problems with logistical and supply issues as the Germans did. There's not many roads up there. And in this case, partisans often supported the Germans. You had the so-called True Orthodox movement. You had Estonian nationalists. You had Finnish nationalists that were still there. But of course, Canaris and his Avir intelligence operation said they're not really a threat and they're not getting their numbers replenished from the east. And this is one place where local Slavic nationalist action would have been helpful. General Govorov, the Soviet commander in charge of this operation, and helped create the shock concept in Soviet mentality, which was a counter to the German Blitzkrieg. There's also a time where the Soviets used their Marine Corps to great effect. It was the Estonian intelligence that tipped the Germans off to the Soviet counterattacks. And but before Germany could do much, the Soviet Eighth Army went into action. And again, intelligence had completely misunderstood everything. The German forces had lost a minimum of 300,000. Half their combat strength was gone by the breaking of the Leningrad siege. There was even an attempt to restore an independent Estonia at the time, and the Estonian nationalists were extremely pro-German and did some excellent partisan work for them. But the Soviets did move with greater efficiency. They had more men, they had more supplies, and their partisan movement was extremely motivated. Breaking through the Narva, the section in between Finnish Gulf and Lake Peipus, was absolutely essential. They needed to drive the Germans from Estonia and expose Finland, and then the possibility of an invasion of East Prussia became very real once that occurred. And Stalin puts this as the first blow, the first strike, which makes a lot of sense because in many ways it often gets neglected, but it's extremely important that the northern wall of Hitler's invasion was crumbling. The second was the Dnieper-Carpathian offensive, late 43 to spring of 44. There'll be a few of these strikes where the Germans are driven out of Ukraine. The Soviets created their eastern wall, Soviet bridgeheads on the right bank of the Dnieper. And these installations grew. And the front here was extremely wide, extremely deep. And this is the strike that took Ukraine from the Germans. One of the disasters here was that this is where the German army was cut off and isolated on Crimea. This is a gigantic loss. This meant the Soviets now control the Lviv-Odessa Railway, which was the Army Group South supply route. There, the Army Group South now was split into two parts, divided by the Carpathian Mountains. So you have the Army Group North Ukraine, Army Group South Ukraine. And their huge supply route was gone, while the Soviet supply route through Persia, Lend-Lease, was opened even more so. About 4 million combatants were connected to this front. Leon de Grille says that the average lifespan of an SS officer was 3 months. During the second strike here, a minimum of 20 divisions were either destroyed or reduced to a fraction of their strength for the Germans. The number of divisions below 50% of their combat strength was at least 60. Thousands of tanks and trucks were destroyed. I said that the wet weather is not a major factor, but the mud certainly is. Spring is the enemy as much as the winter is. Tippelskirch, German general, says that this defeat is just as bad as Stalingrad. And you have top commanders like, of course, Erich von Manstein and Eduard Kleist, could not stem the tide. Manstein, who eventually became field marshal, Erich von Manstein, was one of these guys who saw Hitler as an ignoramus, hated the fact that he was in charge of Germany. He was a royalist, wounded in World War I, hated Weimar. His son was killed at the front. And this is one of the reasons he stayed as loyal as he did. He gets a lot of attacks. He gets attacked a lot for not bailing out the men in Stalingrad, but of course that's not up to him. His hands were tied. So because this was so important to Hitler, we are, you know, even 44 at a point of disintegration here. 8 divisions, at least, and 26 divisions. 8 divisions between January and February, 26 between March and May from Western Europe and Army Group Center for the failing Southern Front. Talking about 35 divisions, depending on who you read, about 500,000 men and 1,000 tanks. And he's pulling them from Western Europe, bringing them back to Western Europe again. One of the reasons Army Group North, for example, wouldn't allow a rotation is that if they gave soldiers a period of rest and relaxation, Hitler would take them and send them elsewhere. So they kept them at the front. So now we have, you know, North Africa forever lost. We have Ukraine forever lost. And now the oil of Romania is a target, as is Finland. And Finland, as you know, will soon sign a peace. Not to mention the fact that D-Day is going to be much, much easier. So all told, during this period of time, the garrison on the French coast lost about 46,000 men, about 400 tanks and heavy weapons. And they took from Army Group Center, too. A huge number of men. They're running out of reserves. They really don't have reserves, unlike the Soviets. And it's just a matter of shuffling them around where they could best be utilized. The third is the Odessa offensive in spring of 1944. That's what took the Crimea. And the second and third really are very closely connected. This is the slow dissolution of Army Group South. Germany at this point lost the equivalent of 10 excellent infantry divisions on Crimea. The average loss for all units in this area was about 50%. The 17th Army was more or less destroyed, and the Romanians were slowly being pushed out of the war. Morale collapsed. It affected Army Group Center, of course, because they had to pick up the slack. And Stalin's continuously bringing in men from the Urals that German intelligence knew nothing about. The summer of 1944 was going to be a miserable one. Once the 4th Ukrainian Army of the USSR got to the southern part of the Dnieper, the Crimean Army for the Germans was then completely isolated. And these eastern Ukrainian battles are some of the most important events of 1944. There was no point at that point of even wearing the Soviets down, let alone winning anything. The fourth is the Vyborg-Petrovgorsk offensive from June to August of that year. Both the Vyborg and Petrovgorsk. This occurs in the summer, which the majority of Hitler's defeats did not occur in the wintertime. This came directly from the Leningrad defeat. Both Romania and Finland are set to lay down their weapons. The fourth strike sees the Finns digging in for years at this point. Three lines of defense. This is summer, so the great advantage of the Finns was now gone. Finnish morale was always very high, but Soviet abilities now were not underestimated anymore. The Soviet planning took the northern sections far more significantly than, more seriously than the Germans did. The USSR now had 20 divisions, at least two armor brigades in the area. They used rockets heavily. Taking the Crimea permitted the US to pour more material in. And 1,600 combat planes were brought in. The Navy was also very important in the Baltic fleet. The Soviet 7th Army failed to break Finland's defenses, and they were defeated for a time. But of course, it's inevitable. The offensive succeeded in reclaiming East Karelia and driving the Finnish army out entirely. But the army was able to move north, which irritated the Reds. And so they maintain their manpower. So this is the Soviet offensive in Karelia in 1944, connected with the Soviet-Finnish War. And the threat to Leningrad now has been eliminated. And Finland now knocked out of the war. But because the Finnish soldiers were able to escape, you know, it was upsetting to the Soviet high command. And in fact, the Soviets did a bit of a reshuffling of their command structure because they let the Finns escape. And Mannerheim was a decent man. Here's something that Mannerheim says in his, who was a military commander in Finland at the time. He says, according to the information received from the Allies, the Soviet government decided to absorb Finland. Steinhardt, the American ambassador to Turkey, told our man that their attack came as a complete surprise for the West, and it caused great concern in Washington. It was expected that the Red Army, due to its superiority in force, would enter Helsinki at the latest in mid-July, and even if Finland had remained independent, there was still a danger of occupation. Fully aware of what the Soviet occupation would mean, the United States wanted to prevent such an event, but Ambassador Steinhardt did not hide the truth that influencing the Soviets was almost impossible. Now, I find this interesting because this is a rare admission that the U.S. knew exactly what Stalin was, and yet continued to build him, assist him, and defend him. That the ambassador to Turkey was well aware of what was happening. One of the reasons that Hitler was concerned with Army Group South so much was to prevent Turkey from entering into the war. They maintained their neutrality. They would have come in on Hitler's side had they won in Stalingrad, but keeping an army down there was extremely important to Hitler for, among other reasons, maintaining Turkish neutrality. But still, this strike, so to speak, was the way that Finland was finally knocked out of the war. The Vyborg attack was the most successful. Over 10 days, the army advanced almost 100 miles and broke through the Finnish lines of defense, took Vyborg, and this is the 23rd Army. And only parts of the 3rd Finnish Army Corps escaped. So they got back. The Winter War has been avenged, apparently. Though through the Swedish Foreign Ministry, the Finns sued for peace. The conditions were tightened this time. Demand for unconditional surrender, but that was softened a bit later on. And Finland remained allied with Germany no matter what the official statement was. The 5th was Operation Bagration. Same time as the 4th. It's named after Peter Bagration, who died in 1812, a Georgian prince fighting with Russia during the Napoleonic Wars, who also had some kind of a shock method in his mentality. And he advocated the use of irregular forces like the Cossacks to weaken the enemy. But this operation removed the last German forces from Soviet territory. And Army Group Center remained strong up until this point. This is the first strike that's dealing with Army Group Center. And they were regularly inflicting heavy losses on the Soviets, despite bleeding for manpower. But now Army Group South is in serious trouble, so now it makes Army Group Center even worse off. The 4th strike did the same to the north as the early ones did to the south, this now for the center. The army had redeployed a third of the Army Group Center's artillery to the south. The entire operational reserve in the Eastern Front was now fully mobilized. There was nothing left. Center only had about 600 tanks against the roughly 5,000 that the Soviets were able to bring against it. This is an area where the Soviets used deception. They hid an entire theater of action from the Germans. Almost 300,000 replacement troops were brought in without being noticed by anybody. And you might want to, you wonder what is happening here with intelligence. The failures of German intelligence is one of the central reasons for the defeat. But all told, German intelligence underestimated Soviet strength by almost half. Because the U.S. sent over 400,000 trucks to Stalin. The Germans underestimated that by 300%. Intelligence Avir said the Soviets could field maybe 1,000 tanks, but they threw almost 6,000 at Germany at this point. There was a total ignorance about the threat against Group Center, and it could have been the strike of all of them. The Soviets knew German moves, but the reverse was not true. But these failures need to be explained, I think. Now, NKVD agent Alexander Demyanov penetrated German intelligence in early 42 by claiming to be a anti-Stalinist Russian. And he claimed to be a part of an anti-communist underground within the army. He said that he was the communications chief, the headquarters of military planning. He'll be sending regular intelligence to Germany. There's another one who you may have heard of, Anton Trakul. Did the same thing, claiming to be anti-communist. He sought German protection. And this is why the Soviets could do what they did. Trakul helped create the MAX network, M-A-X, which is something that the NKVD created that this guy was supposed to be in charge of, and of course gave nothing but disinformation. This gave the Soviet armies a tremendous advantage. Maybe there's more than incompetence here. These guys have been penetrated substantially. And then he's worried about anti-Hitler Germans penetrating it as well. Canaris tried to blame the SS, but in 44, Hitler had enough of Canaris's failures. It was abolished in 1944 and taken over by Walter Schellenberg, and then thereafter taken over by the SS, which meant that Himmler wasn't largely in charge of intelligence, which is probably not a good thing. This is the greatest failure of the war. It's not the weather, something simple and easy like that. It's far more complicated. This is the Abwehr couldn't see Operation Torture Overlord. Admiral Canaris was definitely anti-Hitler. But in January of 44, John Foster Dulles reported strong anti-Hitler movements in German intelligence, and specifically in German intelligence, including for people like General Ludwig Beck. Canaris was always under scrutiny from Heydrich, putting Alvier under suspicion. This is part of the reason why anti-communist Russians were entrusted. It doesn't explain it. It doesn't excuse it, but this is part of the reason. And this is what led to Bagration taking East Prussia. Absolutely unthinkable just a few months before. The strikes we've talked about so far have taken Poland is encircled, Romania, Finland out of the war, and the East is crumbling all over the place. This is why the Warsaw Uprising occurred. These strikes created this mentality. With huge units going undetected by intelligence, relying on air support, the Germans were essentially moving blindly. Almost 30 German divisions were encircled near Minsk, partially for this reason. So Army Group Center in Belarus is destroyed. Fourth Army is gone. The Ninth Army is mostly gone. The end of effective German resistance in Belarus. And of course, when these countries, Romania, when they, and to some extent Finland, when they make peace with the Soviets, they also have to declare war on Germany. Hans Göring, in July of 1944, this is what he says. So our strongest force seems to be Army Group South Ukraine, which consists of the 6th and 8th Armies, as well as Romanian troops. During the spring battles in March and April, this army group had succeeded in defeating the enemy attacks north of Yassi and finally managed to withdraw a number of divisions into reserve. Up until July, the army group had been conducting a fairly successful defense along the front. But on July 13th, Russians attacked, broke through the army group's front 3 points, and captured Lvov, which is the capital of Western Ukraine. And then the spearheads are running roughly all the way to the Vistula and Brest-Litovsk into the Bug. He's talking about the complete disintegration of not just the front, but the command structure. And Hitler, and he, Gerdigan says this, that Hitler relieves of command anyone who says that the war is unwinnable. But of course, everyone knew this. It was a delay more than anything else. And other members of the Axis began deserting in huge numbers, and Hitler expresses shock at this. Even the Italians that remained loyal to Mussolini were of almost zero combat ability, even harmed the efforts of the Germans. Gurdjieff's strategy, as he lays out, it's to collect everything that he possibly can, and he's talking about the West here, breaking through the thinly held Allied front, near Eifel or Meuse and Liège, and to move towards Brussels and Antwerp, breaking through the enemy forces north, and to be encircled and destroyed. And if that works, weaken the Western Allies to be able to defeat the Russian winter offensive. In that case, he will gain time and shatter the hopes of a quick and easy victory from the West. And what he ultimately wants is a negotiated peace. They're going to be defeated. But the question is, what sort of defeat will it be? Unconditional surrender, which is humiliation and almost certain death, or will it be a negotiated peace? They want to make things as costly as possible to bring them to the negotiating table. In other words, Gurdjieff had identified weak spots in the Allied front in the West, towards Brussels and Antwerp. And if that force can be destroyed, he can then throw it against the East. This is the point. And Gurdjieff says that Hitler was so focused on the West that he didn't understand what was happening on the East. The sixth is Lvov, Sandomierz. Also a summer operation. This is where, Ukraine was completely cleansed of the German invaders, and this is Stalin's words, of course. Bagration is going on at the exact same time. And the point of this Sandomierz operation is to block any more troop transfers from elsewhere in the Reich to reinforce the Eastern Front, which, by the way, was beyond their capacity anyway at this point. There was a huge shakeup again. Army Group North Ukraine was headed now by Joseph Harp, who was chosen in part because he studied at the Soviet Combat Tank School in the early 1930s. The Germans used Soviet military installations for their training to get around Versailles restrictions. The target again is the southern parts of Poland. And, the tips of Western Ukraine and that part of Poland was to be held at any cost. And the Soviets were aware of this. If the Germans had the supplies they needed and proper intelligence, they would have done severe damage. And they could have crushed the Soviets and destroyed their morale. And in this case, now Hungary is in serious trouble. Harp commanded a poorly supplied, exhausted 900,000 men. The rest of the Air Force was assigned here, about 1,000 craft, and more Soviet deception, which, just took advantage of more and more intelligence failures. Konev, who was one of the line commanders of the Soviets, had 4,000 planes under his command, and Soviet morale was very high. The Germans were able to remove themselves from a lot of this, but the losses still were staggering. The Soviets claimed 400,000 casualties from the German side, but about 40,000 POWs. The seventh strike is Yassi Knishev, from summer, late summer to October. South Ukraine, or the Army Group South Ukraine, up until June 1944, had some of the best armored German formations. But these, again, were transferred to the northern and central fronts to stem the Red Army advances in the Baltics. So there's no stable command structure, there's no stable strategy here. It never ends. General Antonescu pleaded for a withdrawal of Axis forces from the Carpathian Danube line. And the issue, of course, was to knock, you know, Romania completely out of the war and to bring Romanian infantry on the side of the Soviets. Most of you know that Antonescu was arrested and brought to Moscow, which I'm sure was a pleasant trip. I don't think he was treated nearly as well as Paulus was. In this particular case, you got about 115,000 POWs. And this also was when the Red Army marches into Yugoslavia. There was a rapid retreat from Greece and Albania, and they were only there to save Mussolini in the first place. But if they didn't move quickly enough, they'd be in the same position as the Crimean forces. And that's what triggered King Michael's coup in Romania. And now the Romanian army is fighting on the Allied side. The 8th is called the Baltic Offensive. We're coming into the fall of 1944, continuing to push the Germans and Allied groups away from Leningrad and to rebuild the industry of the area for the Soviet side. One of the tragedies here was the creation of the Courland Pocket. A pocket is an unfortunate phenomenon. It's what happens when an opposing force moves too quickly, and not everyone moves at the same time. A pocket is an isolated army group, and in this case, it was a very large army group. They didn't fall until the very end of the war. Gerdian was begging Hitler to allow them to retreat because they were needed elsewhere, and Hitler responded to him by saying that the U-boat training centers in the Baltic Sea need to be protected because they're going to create the new U-boat 21, which would paralyze Allied shipping. This was going to be the new plan to not win the war, but make it so expensive for the Allies that they would eventually come to the negotiating table. The new U-boat models were going to be a shock to everybody, and this would change the course of the war. What I don't think he knew at the time was that the Allies had been working on these bunker busters, these bombs that could penetrate deep into the ground and destroy the hardened bunkers and shells and pens that these U-boats were in. So even if that were true and that occurred, the new bombs that the U.S. was putting together would have eliminated that. And the worst part is that when Hitler's pushed out of the Baltics, between 1945 and 1950, they were cleansed of all nationalist elements from Stalin's men. And agriculture was collectivized. Massive famine followed. Make a big deal about the famine that existed in Leningrad during the German siege, and it was very serious. But it's not very much compared to what Stalin was able to impose on the area a short time afterwards. All privately owned plots were confiscated, and as soon as war is over, food production plummets. And this is where the Forrest brothers come from. And they're hysterically condemned in the West. This is a very popular movement to fight the Soviet occupation forces, and of course, in many ways, they were pro-German. And the harder they fought, the greater the cleansing. The 9th strike is the East Carpathian Offensive. And this really goes into 1945. They're taking Hungary out of the war in this case. The Balkans is now being evacuated, and communist partisans are growing in huge numbers. There's a coup d'etat in Bulgaria, 1944, and the Red Army installed Kimon Grigoriev. Was able to bring Bulgaria out of the war and against Germany. But he was a bit too conservative for the Soviets. They eventually replaced him with Dmitriev in 1946. By the end of 44, about 600,000 Bulgarians were mobilized by the Reds. And the final strike was at Petsamo, all of October 1944. And Stalin suggests that the northern campaigns have more significance than what English historians give to them. It's hard to do any operations up there. But there are a few things going on. The nickel mines in Petsamo in Finland are extremely important. They're critical to German armor production. And it was a way to guard Norway against an Allied landing operation. The Lapland War develops out of this because once the Soviets and Finns sign a peace, Petsamo region becomes a part of the Soviet Union. And the Finnish government agrees to use their soldiers to push the Germans out of their territory. Even when Gustav Mannerheim is forced to do this, he writes a letter to Hitler, and this is what he says. He says, "Our German brothers in arms will forever remain in our hearts. The Germans in Finland were certainly not the representatives of a foreign despotism, but helpers and brothers. Even in such case, foreigners are in difficult positions requiring tact. I can assure you that during the past years, nothing whatsoever happened that could have induced us to consider the German troops intruders or oppressors. I believe the attitude of the German army in northern Finland towards the local population and authorities will enter our history as a unique example of a cordial relationship. I deem it my duty to lead my people out of the war. I cannot and will not turn the arms which you have so liberally given to us against Germans. I harbor the hope that you, even if you disapprove of my attitude, will wish an endeavor like myself, all the Finns, to terminate our former relations without increasing the gravity of the situation." In other words, he's being forced to take action against Germany, and he doesn't want to. Finland will drag their feet as much as they possibly can. It took a long time to get them out of Finland. The Allies were upset that the Finns weren't killing Germans as quickly enough for them. And in fact, the USSR threatened to invade unless the Finnish forces actually began to attack German units. But the 20th Mountain Army removed 220,000 men to defend northern Norway, or Finnmark, from the Soviets. And this is where Leon de Grille is able to escape into Scandinavia. And one of the things that de Grille says is that you have these untouched forces in Scandinavia and elsewhere, plus thousands of Germans who are escaping the northern regions, including the Courland Pocket. And the fact that you have Finland, who has no interest in fulfilling its part of the treaty that they were forced to sign. De Grille makes the claim that hundreds of thousands of men could have been mobilized and used elsewhere. So wherever you go, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, or Finland, once the Soviets force them to turn against Germany, they don't do it in an intelligent way. There weren't that many people killed in the so-called Lapland War, and the Finns, in many ways, simply refused to act against the Germans. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not going to pretend. I mean, that was a very, very quick summary of these 10 strikes that Stalin lays out, going for three different theaters, you know, north, center, and south, and what that meant not just for the Soviets, but for Eastern Europe as well. Now, the cold did kill Germans, there's no doubt. But Germany gets cold too. But to claim that Hitler's defeat was because of freezing temperatures is absolute nonsense. It was not an important factor in the defeat. It made life very difficult. German generals were able to blame the cold to deflect blame. Even Goebbels claimed that the invasion stalled due to the weather, and it was a way to remove blame from the, you know, maybe the generals didn't deserve it, but it certainly wasn't the cold. It was very easy to blame the cold for this, though. The Red Army was better prepared, but in 1941, the winter came very early. But it was sporadic. It wasn't consistently cold in the fall of 1941. General Kirill Marichkov, who commanded the 4th and 7th Armies, inspected his men after they'd been driven from Tikhvin, and they're wearing summer uniforms. The German offensive near Rzhiv worked because Soviet advance guard was too cold to be effective. They haven't been issued winter clothing, just like the Germans hadn't been. Now, the Soviet heavy tanks were able to take advantage of the snow because German lighter tanks had trouble with it. Not because it was frozen, it was just too deep. But you notice the strikes that I list, those 10 strikes that Stalin puts out, only two of them, all but two of them, occurred in the warmer weather. Only the Dnieper and Leningrad offensives took place in the cold. This means every major defeat of the Germans occurred during warm weather. There's another myth that, you know, had the invasion occurred a short time earlier, because of problems in the Balkans, they were delayed. They would have taken Moscow because they would have had a longer warm season to work with. But if the invasion had been launched in April or May, the mud would have been a huge problem. So the timing of the invasion was about right. But the Germans had stopped and failed to take Moscow before the frost set in. Both sides froze in Stalingrad. You know, there's Russian writers who seem, you know, they say, you know, General Frost or Marshal Frost defeated the Germans. But General Frost doesn't seem to show up until only after the Germans were already stopped. Soviet soldiers found Germans freezing in the trenches because they were cut off from supplies, not because they were overwhelmed with the cold by itself. November of 1941, November 4th, the temperature dropped to about 20 degrees Fahrenheit. By the time the USSR suffered its first severe cold, it was early December. It was negative 13. But by then, the advance had already been exhausted. But Goebbels was the first to kind of create this notion that the cold is what the problem was. And Napoleon's staff said the same thing. General Paulus's army stalled in the summer in the Stalingrad movement. The Germans were always active throughout the Soviet winters. Always. It didn't stop them. In fact, some could claim that the roadways were in many ways easier in the cold than when it was raining and the mud was just, impossible to get through. Anything that hurt the Germans hurt the Soviets too. Germans knew how to fight in cold weather. Germany is a cold country. The Germans captured Norway under worse conditions, although they were probably better equipped. It's a myth to say that Hitler didn't issue winter uniforms. There's an interesting exchange between Gurdjieff and Hitler. Gurdjieff wrote to Berlin, I'm paraphrasing here, he says, you know, there's almost no winter stuff being sent to us. And Hitler replied to him, that's not true. The quartermaster general informed me winter uniforms have been sent. Then Gurdjieff says, no, the uniform was sent, but I followed the path. Apparently they had a tracking system back then. The uniforms are currently in Warsaw and haven't been sent anywhere for several weeks due to lack of locomotives and the glut of trains on the railways. You can take that for what it's worth. Supply problems existed. I don't know how they'd be sitting in Warsaw for 3 months. But of course, the general staff was well aware that things may go wrong, that the front may collapse, that it may not take Moscow in a few months. So at this point, I'm willing to say that there's a few issues here. The first issue is a failure of German intelligence. The second issue is the refusal to use local forces. And the third comes from General Erhard Raus, commander of the 6th Panzers. And this is what he says. Delays in the arrival of replacements occurred very early in the campaign. The combat strength of some infantry companies dropped to unbearably low levels. The first stopgap measure to be introduced was to screen all service and supply units for men who were fit for frontline duty. When these weren't able to provide suitable men, commanders had to call upon others with almost no training. They were transferred to the infantry as long as they could somehow meet physical requirements. Since proper training facilities were rarely available, the combat efficiency of the frontline units suffered considerably. Another expedient was to form rifle companies with surplus personnel from artillery, anti-tank, or panzer units that had lost their equipment. They'd be committed to them as infantry. In other words, he says when replacements came in, training was actually done on the front line itself. They even created training battalions for a crash course in their, you know, their basic training. Leadership was critically low through most of the war. He says technical skill dropped below critical levels at least by 1943. Rouse says that the combat efficiency of infantry is harmed by their continuous commitment, that there's no relief possible. There's, you know, frontline units are not being brought to the rear. Constant fighting until total exhaustion. Maybe 3 days at the most. And if they were brought to the rear, they were put somewhere else. All forms of leave, even medical leave, was eliminated by 1944. Rouse is extremely significant. He talks about how the Soviets are able to exploit the vast space and the conditions of Russia. Hitler's worst mistake was not to have recognized the impending disaster in manpower. He said he was in denial of the obvious, forcing the German army to fight a series of defensive actions against breakthroughs along overextended front lines without any hope of retreat in the final years of the campaign. And closing one gap, another open. These were incredibly long fronts. And he says that Germany could have matched the manpower and production of the Allies, but that window was very, very, very small. But one of the ways you know that the invasion of the Soviet Union was preemptive is that Germany was in no position to attack her at the time. Absolutely not. German war production didn't really peak until 1944, both in planes and in tanks. But the United States sent $11 billion to the USSR. In the few years of Lend-Lease, 450,000 trucks, 12,000 armored vehicles, including tanks, 11,000 aircraft, and almost 2 million tons of food, almost 20 million tons of military equipment, vehicles, from the West to the USSR, 95% came from the US. So you have almost 20 million tons of equipment come from the US to the USSR. It was 22 million tons that landed in Europe to supply American forces in Europe throughout the entire war. The Persian Corridor, which is one of the big supply routes to support the Soviets, the deliveries there alone were able to maintain 60 full-strength combat divisions for several years. So to claim this Stalin's victory is ridiculous. It's not just that the industrial base was created by the West. It's also that the United States was supplying them. They didn't have to worry about a peasantry when millions of tons of food is being sent through Lend-Lease. And it's being sent right in front of the Germans, and because of their poor intelligence, they have no idea what's going on. Of course, the loss of air superiority is one of the most dominant aspects here. Near the end of the war, a training course for a pilot is only a few weeks, even though they tripled the amount of airplanes they're producing. Although, I wouldn't want to fly in one of those. So, and I'm willing to say, finally, that the superiority in the Soviet tank is something that the Germans didn't foresee and didn't even know about. But even in 43, the T-34 wasn't functioning in huge numbers. The thousands of tanks that the Soviets were getting from the Americans, including their most advanced tanks, the German war production, though it peaked in 44, even late 44, the failure rate, which I've seen various statistics, the failure rate is very, very high. I was surprised to note that American bombing did not really affect war production very much. It did affect the quality of the stuff that they were producing. I would not want to go up in one of those planes. The failure rate of the equipment sometimes was as high as 40%. So this talk has been an attempt to summarize the way Stalin viewed World War II, especially the year 1944, the year where Germany was defeated in his mind. The year where the Allies were eliminated, the Allies meaning Finland and Romania, were kicked out of the war, where German morale was destroyed, where Hitler's cannibalizing, you know, from the west to the east to the west, where he's stressing one group over another, where air superiority is long since gone and intelligence is criminally negligent. As I was saying before, we know that the invasion of the Soviet Union was preemptive because German war production wasn't nearly what it would need to be to support such a war effort. It's simplistic to think that they were just going to take Moscow in a few months. Yet that was part of the plan, but they knew that that was a very good chance it wasn't going to happen. The myths and the lies about this are endless. I know I've packed in a huge amount of material in a short period of time, but this is how Stalin essentially organized his thoughts about World War II. Do what you will with them. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.